But we always say to clients, you're not a family. You don't fire your lowest performing kid.
Welcome back to Evolving Your Workplace, where we discuss real-time workplace issues with experts to get you the best solutions for your company. I'm your host, Carol Schultz, longtime executive coach and professional recruiter and best-selling author. Let's get into it.
Greetings. Welcome back to Evolving Your Workplace. I'm Carol Schultz. Today, we're covering a topic I believe everyone in the workplace can relate to, having difficult conversations. I have Bill Benjamin, partner at the Institute for Health and Human Potential. Bill, I appreciate you joining me today, and I want to spend a bit of time first learning more about the Institute for Health and Human Potential. Mm-hmm. Take us back to the beginning. What inspired you to start it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the company was actually started by my business partner, Dr. J.P. Palou-Frye, and he and I went to high school together. He was working at the stress management clinic at MIT. He was doing a whole bunch of area in high performance. And that's around when the book Emotional Intelligence came out. And he really saw the connection between managing emotions and, you know, high performance in business. And so he started IHHP as a research and learning institute. And I always remember I was working in the computer software field. I have degrees in mathematics and computer science. And he was explaining it to me. I'm like, oh, emotional intelligence, that's a bunch of soft and squishy stuff. But then he explained the brain science of it to me. And I thought, okay, you know what? Actually, that is something I'm struggling with. And so he actually coached me for the next 3 or 4 years. I attended the training, did all the assessments and the work. And it really helped me. It really made a difference for me. And so, you know, 4 years later, we decided to, I decided to leave the computer software field. And that was 24 years ago and do this for a living. So, you know, that's what I've been doing for the last 24 years.
Bill, when you say you were you struggling? It's how exactly? As an employee, as an employer, like what?
Yeah, I had been a high performing individual contributor. And of course, you know, what do organizations do with the high performers? Well, they promote them, make them a manager. Yeah. Well, it turned out I wasn't a very good manager. People didn't really like working for me. I wasn't creating a great culture on my team. And so I was struggling at work. I was also struggling personally. I would have anxiety. I would be stressed. Actually, there's a quote that I heard back then that's always stuck with me. The quote is, I've had a lot of great moments in my life. I just wish I'd been there for more of them.
I love that.
So I'm struggling both personally and in business.
And I can also empathize with being a horrible manager in your first week. Mm. I talked about that a lot. I never ceases to amaze me that companies don't invest in their leaders the way they should be, right? So that's partly what we're here to talk
about. Not all companies. We have some great clients that we work with who do, but not all companies. Yes, that's for sure.
I mean, it's the same thing for me, right? The companies I work with improve exponentially on how they communicate and what that looks like and mm-hmm. so on and so forth. But I would say by and large, that's the exception, not the rule, mm-hmm. you know?
I would agree with that.
Yeah. So, you know, what have you discovered about difficult conversations in the workplace personally?
Yeah. So, I mean, we did some research that started about 7 or 8 years ago. And let me, I'll just tell you the origin story. So really quickly, the origin story of what caused us to do this research was we were coaching two executives at a company who weren't getting along. Like that ever happens, right? And they were coached to have a conversation with each other about the impact they were having on each other. Then when they had the conversation, they come back from the conversation, the coaches ask them individually, how did it go? And they both say, oh, it went great. Yeah. Well, the coaches know better. So the coaches pushed it a little bit and said, yeah, but did you say everything, you know, we agreed you would say? And they both said, well, actually, I got 85, 90, 95% of the way there. The other person started reacting. And so I held back.
Yeah.
I didn't really step in and say that last 5 or 10%. So that kicked off a research study we did of 34,000 people. And we determined that on average, it's 7.56%, rounded up to 8%, that people feel they leave unsaid in a difficult conversation. So we call that the last 8%.
Mm-hmm. So fantastic because, you know, I love when people do that kind of research because that confirms what I've thought for years. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have my own thoughts about this in the work that I do. But what is it about that last 8%, Bill, that you discovered why people are leaving that on the table?
It's because of the way the human brain is designed. So this is where the emotional intelligence work comes in. The brain is designed to default to protection, not risk. So it's a risk to step into a difficult conversation or make a difficult decision. And so we're all wired to avoid, I might upset the person, they might not like me, they might not agree with me, they might not be happy with the decision. So we're all wired to avoid. And in fact, we all have a predictable default behavior. 68% of people in our research, their predictable default behavior in a last 8% moment is to avoid.
You know, I'm a big advocate of what it is to have a culture of feedback, right? I've talked ad nauseum. I've written about it in my book, you know, and at a high level, it's really anybody can talk to anybody below, to the side, or above without any real repercussions of fear of being thrown under a bus, right?
Yes.
How do you get to that?
Yes.
And in the work that I do, it starts at the CEO. It starts at the CEO making a commitment to, you know, here's what I'm committed to putting in place. This is what it looks like, how I see us getting there. And we're not going to just get there tomorrow.
You're absolutely right. And in fact, there's actually two things that go into someone being able to perform or display a certain behavior. So like giving someone feedback. One is, and it's 50%, their own internal skills and attitude. Do they feel confident? Do they feel safe? Do they have the skills? But that's only half of it. The other half is the environment they're in. So as you said, if you're trying to create an environment where people speak up, but senior leaders are shooting their ideas down in meetings, they're less likely to speak up. So our work in terms of, you know, creating cultures and creating organizations that are feedback rich and high performing does absolutely start with the CEO and the senior team, because they have to model, they're creating the culture, and they actually cascade it down through every people leader. Because the other thing is culture doesn't exist across organizations, it exists on teams. So you have to start with the senior team, but then you actually have to cascade it down through the people leaders, because the senior leadership team can be creating a great culture, but if there's certain leaders and managers who aren't, then it doesn't cascade down. So you've actually got to get each people leader showing up and creating a psychologically safe culture on their team.
Exactly. And I'm glad you're using that terminology, psychological safety, because that's super important. And to your point, it has to be done on every team, right? Mm-hmm. You have to provide that team with support, or the leader of that team with the support.
So in our research, I mentioned 68% of people are avoiders. That's their predictable default behavior. But the other 32%, I sometimes fall into this category. I'm in that difficult conversation. The other person's getting defensive. Rather than step back, I step in, but I come on too strong, and now I'm making a mess of it. So we talk about people being either avoiders or make a messers. And what we're teaching is the middle path.
Sure.
To push through the discomfort so you don't avoid, but to do it skillfully so you don't, as you said, have the impact with your words you don't intend, so that the other person can hear you. And again, that's where the emotional intelligence skills come in. Because first of all, you've got to be managing your own emotions. It doesn't matter how good your words are. If you're angry, you have contempt for them, you're frustrated with them, they're going to feel that no matter what your words say. So number one is managing emotions. Then is learning how to say things skillfully, because you can be managing your emotions, but you can say things that trigger the other person's emotions. So it's got to be both.
Yeah, no question. It is definitely a two-sided street, right? Or a two-way street. How do you, you know, emotional intelligence is such a, you know, something we've been talking about for so long. I mean, do you have certain ways to determine what someone's emotional intelligence is?
Yeah, there's a fallacy of self-assessments, which is if we have blind spots, you know, I have empathy, I'm authentic. So in fact, Tasha Yurick's work at Harvard, she found that 85% of people think they're self-aware, but only 10 to 15% are. So the only real way to gauge your emotional intelligence is 360-degree feedback. When we have a 360 tool where you rate yourself on a series of questions and competencies and other people, and then you compare yourself. Now we can, that's individually. We do assess a team. So we do have an assessment where we look at an entire organization and assess by level, by function, you know, how is this organization doing in terms of its culture and the, you know, emotional intelligence elements. So that we can assess at a team level versus an individual level.
Tell me a little bit more about that and how you go about discovering that.
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to understanding human behavior, and human behavior is very driven by social norms, social judgment, modeling of what's accepted, what's reprimanded, And so we really do work with an organization to create a set of norms that start with the senior team, where they norm giving feedback, doing it skillfully, and then push that into the organization. And we do it all at once because you want the identity of the organization to be. One of the questions in our survey, our assessment that most teams score low on, is we name inconvenient truths on our team, difficult to discuss issues. And we all know what happens when those don't get named. Then the issue doesn't get solved. Then there's a meeting after the meeting to talk about what wasn't said in the meeting. And so it's very unproductive. So we kind of create this identity of a team that, no, we name the inconvenient truths. So Carol, if you're giving me feedback or challenging something, I don't think, why is Carol doing this? Where is she coming from? I think, oh no, this is what we've agreed to do as a team. She's got the best interest of the team in mind. And so you create this identity on the teams and across an organization that says, this is how we do things here. We do name inconvenient truth. We do challenge the status quo. We hold people accountable. We just do it in a skillful way from a place of care. And we talk about high care and high accountability cultures.
I love that. How often do you find in a project that you have to, at some point, recommend to the CEO, this person needs to go?
The CEO or somebody on their team?
Could be somebody on the executive team. I always have that conversation. I may realize after this project that you've got somebody who should not be in a leadership. We've done everything we can. They're just yep. not making it work. Or this person is completely out of alignment with the culture. And
yeah,
not everything can be fixed.
Yeah. And so we do coach the CEOs when we do our culture system work. And it's a small percent, but it does happen that there's somebody who just, I mean, the thing is, it's like, you know, when there's a team and they're starting to give each other feedback and they're starting to talk about how they're going to show up for each other and there's a high care, a lot of those kind of challenging, toxic people, they do come along. They do start to recognize the impact they're having. They recognize, you know, how they should be showing up with the team. So a lot of times that improves, but not always. And so that it has been a conversation we've had with a CEO about there's a person that's just toxic to the team. But it's tough. I mean, you know, I've made the mistake of leaving a person in place because they're good at their job. They're hard to replace. I don't have time to deal with it. But one toxic person can derail the performance of a team by 30 to 40%.
Yes. You know, I'll never forget. It makes me think of a story back. This has got to be, wow. Let's see, I've been in Colorado 22 years. This is somewhere, I would say, in the 18 to maybe 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I had somebody I'd worked with in the past when I was still headhunting. And he had taken a job with a company headquartered somewhere here in Colorado as their VP of sales, whatever, you know, whatever the title was at that point. He was the fifth person in this position in 6 years.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Wow.
And, you know, I'll never forget, it was a complete disaster. And because he wanted me to come in and do some work for them. And as I did some research, and in that research, I always do some, let's call it blind reference checking.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay? And I have ways to do that. So one, it doesn't breach confidentiality. And two, the person who's talking to me isn't going to, again, get thrown under a bus. And everyone I talked to had told me that it was the chief strategy officer was a, and I quote, cancer to the company.
Anyway.
Yeah. And, you know, and that included three of the five former VPs of sales and a number of other lower level employees.
But right.
The CEO, as it turned out, was very good friends with one of their venture partners, again, very well-known venture firm. And they had been roommates at college. And they just, you know, when I reached out to the venture capitalist, I knew one of his partners very well. And he said, just call him. We'll talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. He was just trying to remember the right adjective. He was so defensive.
Mm.
Are you saying we don't know how to hire? Are you saying we don't know how to do this? Are you saying... What I'm saying is that, you know, when you have five heads of sales in 6 years,
Something's wrong,
you know, and I just, you know, there's always some blame somewhere else. And of course, the reality is the big problem was the CEO.
Mm.
He allowed this to continue. So out of touch. with what was actually going on in the organization.
Yeah. And by the way, we see that at all levels of an organization, people not wanting to deal with either an underperformer or a high performer that's toxic. I've never met a leader who said, I wish I'd waited longer to deal with one of those two situations. But again, we avoid it because of emotion. We don't want to deal with the outcome. We don't want to deal with the impact. And so that's that whole avoidance. That's a big one for a lot of leaders, is dealing with the underperformer or the toxic person. And by the way, it isn't just, well, let's go right to firing them. It's, are you actually giving them feedback? Does the person even know the impact they're having? Are they aware of the situation? Because, I mean, 95% of people, they want to do well. They want to do better. They don't want to have a negative impact on people. So many times, and you've had this experience, Carol, somebody gives somebody some coaching and they do it in a good way. And the person's like, oh, I had no idea. Okay, I want to get better. And so, yeah, it isn't just, well, you got to move right to firing. It's also, are you giving them feedback?
Well, right. And that's my whole point. If you've gotten to that point, you've done everything you can. Sit back and observe and do the work and ask the right questions before we ever get to this point. I always say to a CEO ahead of time, this could happen at the end of the project.
Yeah, that's a great question.
They typically will. They will. And if they don't, I won't do the project with them. I'm not going to put myself. I mean, I think we've all done that. Put ourselves into positions with, you know, clients. We later on say, "Oh shit, we never should have taken that." What was I thinking?
Yes, or knowing what we learned partway through, we should have stopped and said, look, this isn't working because of X, Y, and Z. So been there, absolutely had some clients where it wasn't working. Yeah.
You know, and listen, you know, what do they say? Experience is a wonderful thing. It enables us to recognize our mistakes so we don't make them again.
Absolutely.
None of us is without fault. None of us has never made a mistake. Right. And I think that's just the important thing is, you know, we have to be accountable in the same way we expect our clients to be accountable.
Absolutely. We like to say we want to be better than what we sell as an organization.
Really great.
Isn't that good?
You know, from a standpoint of the company was founded in 2002 or before that?
The company was actually founded in 1998. I joined in 2002. Yeah.
Okay. What has been, so who are your prospects? Like, not who specifically, but, you know, what's your, let's call it your ideal customer profile, right? Your ICP, we all talk about that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, typically it's an organization with 500 or more employees where it's typically not something's broken or toxic. It's a good to great opportunity. It's a CEO and a senior team who have a growth plan, and they recognize that in order to drive growth, they need to, you know, improve their culture in some way. A good example would be Blue Cross of Idaho, one of our good clients. They recognize a need to be more innovative. They wanted to be an employer of choice because, you know, they're in Boise. It's hard to attract people. And so Paul Zerlo, the CEO and the senior team, recognized that culture was going to have a huge impact in them being more innovative and being an employer of choice. And we were able to, you know, make a big impact on that for them.
I imagine.
It's just the robustness and richness of our culture system and what it takes to implement. Typically, we aren't finding companies with less than 500 employees are willing to make that investment commitment. I mean, there are some. You said ideal. We absolutely work with some smaller clients, but our ideal client is 500 and above.
What do you think is standing in the way when you say, you know, but the majority of smaller companies aren't really interested? What do you think that's about?
I mean, I think it's about not recognizing the importance of culture, not recognizing the importance of developing your, because, you know, the work is also about leadership, right? It's kind of like, you know, and like you said, right? I like what you said about, you know, you don't have business problems, you have personal problems to show up at business, of helping people, you know, develop their emotional intelligence, develop some of these skills to step into last 8% moments. The positive impact that can have on their strategy, on their business outcomes, and the willingness to, you know, kind of make that investment. And it isn't just, you know, the money they spend with us, it's the time. And it's not a lot of time we're asking for, but it's enough that, you know, you've got to be willing to make that commitment.
I agree. How much time is that typically, would you say?
So with the senior team, we have an assessment phase where we do our, you know, quantitative assessment. We also do qualitative interviews. And we typically do 3 in-person senior team sessions. Now that can be spread over 3, 4, 5 months. Then with the people leaders, we have something we call sprints. So down below the senior team that people do kind of in the flow of work in their team meetings, where you take approximately 30 minutes per team meeting to talk about your culture, what kind of team do you want to be, what's your identity, some of those things, how are they handling their last 8% moments, all of that they talk about in those team meetings. So for the people leaders, it's all done virtually and it's quite a bit less time.
Yeah, I would imagine. Well, and the in-person time always takes longer, right? Because you have to start with the executive team. Do you typically call right into the CEO?
I mean, we don't call, but we are going to events where CEOs are there, or we just spoke at the National Association of Corporate Directors, which is actually board members, because boards have a culture. They're a team that doesn't always function as well as they could. And then they can recommend to their CEO and the organization, they can make recommendations. So we also work with boards as well as CEOs.
Because when I do my assessment, my initial assessment, I always include the board. So what has been the growth path?
Yeah, I mean, most of our consulting culture, consulting leadership development clients come through our keynote speaking.
Yes.
So myself and my business partner, JP, we're relatively frequent keynote speakers at leadership conferences, association meetings, National Association of Corporate Directors that I just mentioned. So, because that way, people get, it's a 90-minute, sometimes half-day session that's very practical and applicable, and people get exposure to the work and they say, that last 8% thing, I think that's something we're struggling with. That would help us, that would help us execute our strategy. That would help us reach our growth targets. And so typically comes through the keynote speaking.
Yeah, that's fantastic. What would you say is your biggest bottleneck to growth right now?
I mean, it is what's happening with the economy and all the uncertainty. I could argue now is a time when clients need it even more, but they don't always, they don't always see it that way. So folks are starting to hesitate on just even having events where the people are speaking. They're hesitating on making investments. And so we just are an economically sensitive business. It just is the way it is. And so that's the, right now the only thing that's holding us back. We have a great value proposition and great clients. And
right. Well, and it's interesting because this is, what you're describing is not uncommon when people are worried about the economy, right? So would you say that economy is right now the one thing that if solved would make the biggest impact?
I mean, yes, except that's external to us. So we have to continue to work at the things that we can control, the things that we can do. So we are, we are doing lots of things to say, how do we get in front of people so they can understand what we do, our value proposition? And so, continuing to execute on those things. So we're focusing on things we can control, because obviously nobody can control the economy, right?
As much as they are trying to control the economy, they really aren't going to do that. Bill, is there anything that we haven't talked about that I have neglected to ask you or bring up?
Yeah, I'd say the only thing we haven't talked about, and it wasn't because you neglected it, I just didn't bring it up. I think the other piece of content that people really, really appreciate and literally pull out their phones and take pictures of it is we have a culture map based on our last 8% research and another study of 72,000 people where we identified it, and also through others' work, Sarah Sewell at Stanford, that there's two key pillars to a high-performance culture. One is connection. That's psychological safety. That's people feel valued. They have a voice. The other that a lot of organizations miss when they do culture or values work is courage, the ability to do difficult things. What we just talked about, to skillfully do difficult things, to step into last 8% moments. And so we created a culture map, and it's a 2x2, and I'll just describe a couple of the quadrants. So if you think of a culture that's high courage but low connection, that's more transactional. That's results matter over relationships. You do have your toxic bad apples. It's a high stress, high burnout. It can achieve results over the short term, but not the long term. Then if you think of a culture that is high in connection but low in courage, that's more of a family culture. It's a nice culture, but people are unwilling to do hard things. It's more of an avoidance culture. The people don't have conversations because they don't want to upset people. Everyone's trying to be nice. The slower decision making, because you have to get everybody to agree. And most of our clients, in our research, 30% of organizations and teams are in that quadrant, the high connection but low courage. And a lot of our clients are in that quadrant. And that really resonates with a lot of people. And, you know, there's lots of positive things about a family culture because there's high care, there's high trust. But we always say to clients, you're not a family. You don't fire your lowest performing kid.
Thanks for listening to Evolving Your Workplace. Is there a topic you want to discuss? Let us know what you think in a review. And don't forget to click follow to stay up to date on upcoming episodes. Thanks again for listening and see you next time.